So let's start with something which I think is very obvious, but until you say it, then maybe it's not obvious. And that is that as we traveled through Jewish history, and you can start at any point you want, and you can end at any point you want, there are elements of the history which we should note have what I would call a cyclical aspect to them. There are things which repeat themselves. There are things which seem to have impacted other things. And it's not necessarily that every single moment in history is absolutely unique and is never, I don't want to say never repeated, but is completely independent. And obviously, when it comes to certain elements, including the Holocaust, we could question, is this something which is unique? And I'm not talking about history now, as much as looking at something which is a little bit broader, because where I want to get to with Parshat Meraglim is really what the impact. And Chazal are very clear about this, and the Chazal, when they speak about it, they don't always tell you everything which they know, because they assume that you know more than actually you do. And that is when they'll say, for example, that God said to Am Yisrael that night when they cried in their tents, that your crying was a bechinam, you cried for nothing, and that there's going to be a bechira l'dorot, and you're going to cry throughout the generations on this day. So essentially what Chazal are saying then is that there is a direct path between the Cheder Meraglim and the Chorban Beit HaMikdash, and the first and the second, and the math is essentially one where you can follow, again, Chazal, that this was on Tisha B'Av when they came back, and therefore all the things in history, and you can just start with the Mishnah in Ta'anit, which says all these things happened on Tisha B'Av, and essentially all of this goes back to the Cheder Meraglim. Which means that when we look at the various aspects in the desert, especially, there were times that there were events, there were episodes which were problematic. It's hard to find or to point our fingers at another one which were really as devastating in terms of long-term impact as this one is. Which means this is the one which seems to have so much more in terms of what happened afterwards. And that itself is worthwhile noting. Because again, at face value, we could begin to question, what really is so bad? Which of the stories are worse? I'll tell you something which I've said before and you may find interesting. When we get to next week's Parsha, we're going to find that Moshe and Aaron do something which is deemed inappropriate. And when they do it, they're told afterwards, okay, that's it, you can't go to the land of Israel. And what they do is, at least from our perspective, is relatively minor. So then the way that you'll respond to it being relatively minor, the way that you respond to it is saying, oh, because they're in such a high level, when someone's at such a high level, there's something relatively minor, so then it can have terrible consequences. So yes, I get the dynamic, I understand the question, I understand the answer, but I hope that on some level you appreciate that that's not really satisfying, because there are things here which are worse. What I was going to get to is that it shouldn't terribly surprise you that there's at least one commentary who says, no, 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 no. This is just said this way because we don't want to pin on Moshe or Aaron much worse things which they are guilty of. And Aaron's death actually is connected to the Chet HaEgel. And Moshe's death is actually connected to the Meraglim. But God, put it this way in order to what are you going to put on the tombstone afterwards? Okay, they didn't get to the, they weren't Mekadesh Am Yisrael sufficiently. Now that I think it's Aruch Chaim who says that. Now that is just so absolutely fascinating. Not because he claims that there's a cover up. It's because what he's saying makes more sense than maybe we're willing to admit right now. Because again, when you think about consequences, the Chet HaEgel, that's really big. So you think, okay, what should Aaron be guilty of? His part of the Chet HaEgel, and you can answer anything you want in terms of why and how and what. That doesn't concern me. But Aaron didn't do anything during he stood on the side as Moshe, God said, speak to the rock, and Moshe hits the rock, and Aaron is standing there. So yes, I know, I've said this before, you can blame Aaron for not doing anything. And God appointed him as the one to speak, and he should have spoken. And therefore, Aaron's not speaking, but still, you're going to tell me that Aaron's lack of behavior, lack of speaking, is ultimately what he's going to be punished for, but his part of the Chet HaEgel, that's all forgiven. Especially when you get to Sefer Devarim, and Moshe tells over the story and says, oh yeah, and by the way, God wanted to kill Aaron. hour at that point, and I davened for him, and at least I was able to keep him with us. So you say, hold it. There was a death sentence on him right then, according to Moshe. Right, Moshe. I'm not talking about Rashi. Moshe says there was a death sentence on Aaron right there. So therefore, to say, yeah, ultimately, that's the reason he can't continue the land of Israel is because of that, rather than because of whatever happened by May Meriva. And as far as Moshe goes, okay, what is Moshe's part in this, in the sending of the spies? And again, it's a little bit more complicated, but my point is, without going through each element, I'm asking myself and all of us a question. So what really is worse? Are you really going to tell me that hitting the rock is really worse than this episode, when that episode, we don't really see how it impacts other things moving forward, other than, of course, Moshe not being able to go into Israel, versus over here when God says this whole generation can't go in? And then you start thinking, except for Kalev, and then we'll see Yeshua. And then you say, hold it, isn't Moshe part of this generation? So when everyone can't go in, so maybe there really was somebody else also who was involved in this. So as I said, this one is the one which is worse. And when I said before, Chazal assume that you know something, what Chazal assume that you know are the verses in Tehillim in chapter 106, Kufav. You take a look over there, because it sounds very much as if it says over there that because of the Chet HaMeraglim, God then determined to disperse them throughout the nations. So the that what do you mean disperse? We're on the way to Israel. No, there will be a Chorban, there will be a Galut, and all of that is written already long before the Mishnah tells us this. This is already written, and I said that's what Chazal assume that we know. As I said, it's a very bad assumption. They assume that we know this, that yeah, it's the Chet HaMeraglim. This is a really important one, because it's a commentary on Sefer Bamidbar. And for that, a little bit of Shemot also. It goes into the Chet Egel. It goes to all the things that we did wrong. And I'm going to say it again. Chazal just assume we know this, and unfortunately, we don't necessarily. So let's now try again. I'm not going to say start again, but let's now try again. There are various stains on our collective identity. And now the question is, how far back do you want to go, or what is the collective? Which means, if I were to say, so what are the worst things that Am Yisrael has done? So I just now really limited it, and then you could debate what Am Yisrael means. But I want to be, at first, the most inclusive that I can. So the various stains that take place in Sefer Bereishit, we really have two major ones. One towards the beginning and one towards the end. Towards the beginning, obviously, is the sin of whatever takes place in the Garden of Eden. The sin of Eve and Adam. And yes, we should give Eve more credit in this. Just being fair, that's all. And then the sin towards the end, the last third of Bereishit, and that is Mechirat Yosef. So those two are these stains. And of course, the second one is one which more so impacts Am Yisrael, because as I said, you know, who we are as a people, there's just something terribly wrong which took place there. Okay, when we get to Sefer Shemot, then we have the Chet HaEgel. And now we have the Chet HaMeraglim. And these seem to be the major things that have taken place. And we could debate which one is worse and which one is better. Now, I would actually argue that all of these things that I just now said are actually on some level interconnected. Now, of course, if somebody's clever enough, they can connect any two things. It's a little more difficult to connect three things or four things or five things. But there is something which, remarkably easily, one can connect things over here. Let me speak. It will be remarkably easy to make connections of these things. Start for a second. Over here, by the Meraglim, we're told that they went and they traveled for 40 days. So I ask you, do you remember anything else that took place over 40 days? And that's, of course, Moshe going up, and they're waiting for Moshe to come down. And as we get to the end of that 40th day, you have the Chet HaEgel, you get to the end of the 40th day, you now have the Chet HaMeraglim. It just is something which is interesting. If you remember the Rashi, which is really interesting and maybe even disturbing, right, when it says Yom L'Shana, Rashi notes, but there's only 39 years left, because they're already in the second year. He goes, no, they got the punishment for 40 years in the desert already based upon the Chet HaEgel, but they got a suspended sentence. And now when they sinned again, God canceled the suspended sentence, and now they got the punishment for the chet ha'egel. Now, again, the reason why that's so interesting is what Rashi is really doing is he's saying, you know, these two things are interconnected, and the punishments are interconnected, and we could debate which one is worse, because in a certain sense, one should have to say that the chet ha'egel is worse. The things they hear directly from God, I'm God who took you out of Egypt, make no other gods, and now they make another god and say, this is what took us out of Egypt. There is just something profoundly wrong with this in terms of a sin against God. On the other hand, there's something which is, there's something very wrong about what happens over here. Now, as I said, that was too easy. The other thing, if I go back to Yosef, when Yosef meets up with his brothers after all of those years, and he comes and he asks them a question, and as soon as they respond, what does he say? Miraglim atem. So therefore, just in case you think that that was really hard for me to make a connection between Mechir Yosef Miraglim, no, that was not very hard for me. That was really, really easy, because the word Miraglim is, by the way, if you were really clever, then you would point out that the word Miraglim does not appear at all in this week's Parsha, that the word Miraglim is only found in Dvarim, in a retrospect, which means Moshe didn't send Miraglim. They were Miraglim, right? So Moshe never sent Miraglim. Moshe sent, and that itself is interesting. Why did Moshe send? What's the purpose? So let's slow down, and we'll see how many of these things I'm going to get back to. When it comes to the sin of Adam and Eve, so there is a, this should be very simple, there is a fruit involved. Over here, a fruit. A tree, a fruit. There's a fruit and a tree, right? So this should not be all that difficult. When Moshe sends them, he says, "Oh, check if there's a tree, and then bring the fruit." Which means, to what extent did the fruit? Now you could say, "Okay, it's a little random." No, it's not random. None of this is random. All of this is connected. And now the only question is, on what level we want to have this conversation, and. If you want to see, you know, how connected this is, then I have to, you know, go back and deconstruct and reconstruct and show what's going on. But yes, admittedly, I am not speaking on the obvious pshat level, but it's something which is right beneath the surface, but it's there. This is not my imagination. It's something which is there. And once you realize that it's there, then everything changes. And now let me just pause for a moment and speak just in terms of methodology, and then this is going to help you a lot. One of the things that one should keep in mind when they study Sefer Bamidbar is the interrelationship between the mitzvot and the narrative, which means essentially at its core, Sefer Bamidbar is a book of narrative. But within the narrative, there are all of these mitzvot that are thrown in. So it's my contention, and this can be debated, and there are those who seem to move away from the way that I'm saying it, but I think it's so obvious that, I'll say it again, it's my contention, and I cannot be the first. I mean, it's again, because it's too obvious, that the various mitzvot which are thrown in are strategically placed because of the narrative which is there. What we could have done, which we're not, because I said there's something more that I want to get to, what we could have done is we could have skipped over the Miraglim completely, just look at the mitzvot in this week's parasha, and then paused and asked ourselves, huh, what is this, or how is this connected to the chet and the Miraglim, and why is this being introduced at this particular point? What I'm alluding to in terms of somebody who seems to say differently is if you read the introduction of the Ramban to Bamidbar, he makes it sound like, okay, God just had a couple extra mitzvot and he threw them out, you know, indiscriminately, and just because, you know, there are a couple more in the bag, and okay, here, take this one, and this one. And it's a little hard to be convinced that that's really what's going on over here. Okay, so now let's. I get the feeling that the Ramban is addressing the book of Bamidbar that should have happened, as opposed to the one that did happen. If you got that, then very good, because that's I think what he's doing. That. There's a path. The path is from Sinai to Eretz Yisrael. And then there's these mitzvot that have to be there. And it sounds as if he's not necessarily dealing with then the reality which emerges. Because then you'd be left with the question, hold it a second. Let's say Parshat Tzitzit. It's at the end of this week's parsha. And for us, v'lo taturu acharei levavchem v'achareinichem, lo taturu, the word taturu over here, latura ta'aretz, which means, how do you miss that connection over here? Don't follow, lo taturu acharei levavchem v'achareinichem, asher etnu zimrachem, don't see things and don't let your heart take you astray and then end up making a false narrative, right? Which, so how do you miss that? You can then get into the issues of the blue and the white, and the blue's connected to heaven, and don't be so logical, be a little bit more idealistic and so on. And I said, I could easily give a whole drasha just based on that, but nonetheless, then if you're the Ramban, hold it. This is only introduced because there was a chait, which means there wouldn't have been a chait, and there wouldn't, which means you end up going down a rabbit hole, which I don't want to go through. But I will say it's very interesting to read the Hakdama of the Ramban, to read the Hakdama of the Netziv, and to compare them in terms of what they think this book actually is. Okay. Let's now try again. Do we have enough things out there to consider? Okay, I believe that we do. So, the other thing, just, and now you'll realize why this is too much to do all in one day, but the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that we have the narrative as it is presented to us here in Bamidbar, and then we have the narrative as Moshe tells us the retrospective in Sefer Devarim. And the way that Moshe tells it and the way that it's over here, what I would say, if one really wants to understand this properly, you need to read Bamidbar properly, you need to read Devarim properly, and then you need to read them together and say, okay, now, what happened? And the biggest issue, Rashi already told us, which I think is the biggest issue, which essentially, where does the idea come from? Over here, it sounds like it's a divine, not just suggestion, a divine command. V'deber Hashem Moshe le'mor shlach lecha anashim v'yitur et eretz kanan asher ninatein levnei Yisrael. Right, go and send these people. Now, there's one word here which is difficult, and that's the lecha. It should be shlach anashim. Why shlach lecha anashim? Which means the lecha is problematic. If you compare this to what it says in Devarim, which is in source number 7, then it says it was a grassroots movement, v'tikrevun elai kulchem, v'tomru nishlacha anashim lefaneinu v'echpu lanu et ha'aretz v'shuvu otanu davar et haderech asher naleba v'et harim asher navo elayim. The people had the idea, v'yitav be'inai ha'davar, and Moshe thought it was a good idea. And so over here, it's from the people, and Moshe thinks it's a good idea. Now, I'll say it again. This has such dramatic negative consequences. But Moshe in Devarim, by the way, this is a remarkable leader. Moshe in Devarim could have said the other way around. God gave a command and kind of left out the whole background, but he doesn't do that. He says, listen, you guys started this. I thought it was a good idea. And, you know, look how terribly this all worked out. So I'm saying this honesty of Moshe, again, don't please for a moment think that I'm suggesting Moshe doesn't have honesty. But there would have been another option to have told the story, because you can always tell stories in different ways. And how many of us tell over stories in a way that we end up looking good? Which means, I forgot, you know, there's some kind of a psychological study, how often we lie in a day. And it's even by presenting things and how we present things. And it's not the kind of lie that you say, well, you shouldn't, thou shall not lie, but it's this misrepresentation of certain things. Over here, shlach lecha anashim versus the people. So there's something interesting here. To continue with it, v'yishlach otam Moshe al pi Hashem, right? Kulam anashim roshei b'nei Yisrael hema. So here's something which God commands to do, and here our leaders are sent, which means we have every reason to believe right now that things are going to work out very well. And now again, I want to pause. It's especially because of the interaction and the interconnection between these various episodes that we need to understand something, that wherever there's a possibility for great destruction, there's also a possibility for great construction, which means that potential can be utilized in more than one way. And if over here something takes place which is just so devastating and so negative, it means that there was also a potential right over here for something to have been so positive and so redemptive. So don't get fooled in saying, oh, look at this. God had a plan in order to destroy already the first and second Beit HaMikdash, and he started that plan right over here. Yes, that's what ended up happening, but that doesn't mean that that was the only trajectory that could have taken place. And that doesn't mean that things could not have worked out very, very differently. And again, just to understand a little more, we're going to skip over the names, right, Pasuk? I'll tell you, I suspect that in Moshe's mind, it may have actually been exactly the same. And I'll look at source number 3, which is Lech Lecha. I just skipped the Lech Lecha pasuk. V'yelech Avram kasher diberi lev Hashem, v'yelech yitolot Avram ben chamesh shanim v'shiv mishana b'tzeitom yicharan. So that's when Avram goes, Lech Lecha, and Avram goes and picks up and goes. Now this is a problem over here, which is a very subtle problem. And the subtle problem is solved by different people in different ways. Now, admittedly, all of us miss this, right? We don't even have the bandwidth to really even notice the problem. But the problem is that Avram leaves twice. He leaves in two psukim, one after the other. Pasuk Dalid, he leaves, and Pasuk Hei, he leaves. Pasuk Dalid, Vayelech Avram kasher diberi lav Hashem. Vayelech ito Lot. And Lot goes with him. Lot follows him. Pasuk Hei, Vayikach Avram etzarai ishto, vit Lot ben achiv, vit kol ruchu sham asher rachashu, vit nefesh yishu bilcharan. Now make up your mind. Hold it. Which one is it? Which means our minds are trained to avoid conflict and trade and trained to make believe problems don't exist. So we smooth over these problems and first of all, you ignore it. And secondly, you just kind of, okay, just tell me the same thing twice. No, why would you tell the same thing twice? But it's not just that it tells you the same thing twice. It's not the same thing. It said Avram went as God commanded him, and Lot went with him. And then it says, and Avram went, and then he took. So, and the big problem is, and then he takes Lot. But hold it, he already went with Lot. So there is a suggestion that Avram went twice. That first Avram went on a pilot trip. First Avram went, interesting, right? Right. First he goes on a pilot trip to go and take a look and to see, you know, where are we going to go? Where are we going to live? And then he goes back and he gets his wife and gets all the stuff. And now we're moving. Now, I hope that resonates with some of you, but you're already asking about Lech Lecha and Shlach Lecha. So therefore, isn't that the way that Avram entered the land the first time? First you go, you take a look, and then you bring everybody and everything. Yeah. So then it becomes perfect. Now, you realize, first of all, that I anticipated your question. Secondly, you realize that, as they say sometimes, that yikar chaser min hasefer, right? But nonetheless, do you realize what just now happened? That our imaginary first trip of Avraham, with that word lecha, lech lecha and shlach lecha, that imaginary first trip of Avraham just now created a rationale of why Moshe would go and do this, because this is the way that we do this. This is how we enter the land of Israel. And as I said, you know, without that, you're just left to say, hold it. Like, where does all that come from? And that at least gives you some kind of a background. Getting back to the names of the people, which is in source number 1, Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Tetzayin, Elishmot Anashim Mashalach Moshe LaTorah Ta'aretz, V'chom Moshe LaHoshea Benun Yehoshua. Of course, Hoshea becoming Yehoshua kind of gives him an extra letter, but that extra letter makes it a Yud Hei Vav, and you know that that is much closer to having God's name within his name. Yehoshua is from the tribe of Yosef, and the other successful spy, we'll call him, is... I'm just thinking, why... I must have at some point named a class Spy versus Spy, which only some of us will still know why I would do such a thing. But the other one was Kalev, who of course comes from the tribe of Yehuda, and Yehuda also has in him Yud Hei Vav. The other thing that you should be thinking of in the background is Yehoshua has already been called Yehoshua before. And he was already called Yehoshua the first time that we meet him. And when's the first time that we meet him? By Mechemet Amalek. Now, just in case you think that that is disconnected, of course Amalek is connected to all of this because it's part of this narrative as well. Right? And when Amalek is defeated, we're told that God's throne, as it were, kis, not kisei, is incomplete, and God's name is incomplete as well. And over here you have God's name almost complete in Yehoshua, or almost complete in Yehuda, but now you realize that these two, who actually are prototypes of Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David, because these tribes of Yehuda and Yosef, so now I'm going to say it again. You know, you look at this by itself and you say, oh, those two, no, it's just not those two. I mean, how do the book of Bereishit end? When you go back to Mechirat Yosef, what emerges from Mechirat Bechirat Yosef, well, two brothers have risen to the top compared to all the others, and one is Yosef, and one is Yehuda. And it's actually Mechirat Yosef, which Yehuda is behind, and then when we try to fix it, that tikkun, is where Yehuda then ends up becoming Yehuda. So I'm going to say all of that is interesting, but it's not as disconnected as maybe you would think it is. And I'm going to go back again. And when Yosef says, oh, Maraglim Atem, I mean, how clairvoyant is all of that? Because there really is something else which is taking place. Well, let me say one more thing about Yosef and about the brothers. Rav Soloveitchik, in his what's called Chamesh Drashot, I think they call it the Rav Speaks in English. So this is now, because a new volume was published, this is the first volume of the Rav's Zionist talks that he gave by the Mizrahi. And in the first chapter, it's called In Yosef Dreamed a Dream. One of the points that he makes about Yosef is that Yosef sees the future while the brothers are only able to see the present. So, and he notes this from such a subtle point that Yosef is dreaming an alumim alumim, which means essentially they became farmers. To become farmers, you need to own land, while the brothers are shepherds. So what kind of dream is this about being farmers when we're really shepherds? But the point is that one day they will own the land, and that's in the future, and then we will become farmers. But by the way, that is part of our problem. Part of our problem is that we resist this point of entering the land and having this profound relationship with the land, which actually means to be farmers. I mean, how many people would prefer to study Zrayim outside the land of Israel than practice Zrayim in the land of Israel? And I'm being very, very serious about that question, because one, people would see more value in, and the other becomes the whole infrastructure for creating a society which is based upon charity, a society which is based upon taking care of the have-nots, a society which is based upon the authentic application of what one should call social justice, going through every single aspect of the mitzvot ha-tluyot ba'aretz. So over here, Yosef dreams a dream and Yosef sees the future, which means Yosef has the ability of seeing what should be and what will be, while the brothers are stuck. And Rav Soloveitchik's point is that essentially what happened in Europe before World War II, that you had some people who saw the future through the present. So, of course, meaning, of course, the majority of the Jewish world, which is very Ashka-centric perspective, is in Europe, and the Jewish communities in Europe have lived for 1,000 years. They'll be here for another 1,000 years. I suspect the Talmidei HaGra would not necessarily agree with that statement. Okay. The Talmidei HaGra. We're here before everybody else. So, well, not necessarily everybody, but I say they wouldn't agree with that statement. But in a certain sense, that's what the spies are doing as well. The spies can't imagine going into this land, and they prefer meaning, we're never told what their end game is. We're never told this. In chapter 14 in Perek Yudalid, when the hysteria spreads throughout the camp, the people, that's Am Yisrael, that's not the spies. They say, oh, let's go back to Egypt. The spies never said that. What is their end game? Okay, what's your plan? Is Uganda your plan? I mean, like, again, what is the alternative? And it sounds like their alternative is that, okay, we're going to stay here because we can't go there. I mean, there were so many other things that they could have said or they should have said. Okay, they look very frightening. I mean, there's one major thing which is lacking in everything in this whole chapter. In Perek Yud Gimel, there's one thing which is lacking other than the very first pasuk. And what's that? God. God is just completely lacking from the entire discussion. And it's worthwhile to go through the whole story from a God-centric perspective. And, you know, I keep asking this. I can't get away from it. I mean, you realize the morning that they came back, all the people that were then protesting, I mean, what did they have? And they were all frightened, and what's going to be, and God hates us, and God wants to kill us, and so on. What did they eat for breakfast that morning? Right? They had man. And what bracha did they make? Hamotzi lechem min hashamayim, which means that there is this unbelievable, profound disconnect between God in their lives and the protected cloud upon them, and you know, taking care of everything. I'm not even talking about, you know, recent history when there was the splitting of the sea and the plagues and so on. Breakfast this morning, right? There's just something which is completely fascinating. And by the way, maybe that's what they prefer. Maybe they prefer not to work the land with Zra'im, not to be the farmers, but I want to learn in Kolel and over here with Moshe Rabbeinu as the Rosh Kolel, and I can sit here and God is taking care of everything. Someone's going to be very upset with me about this, right? It's okay. It's good. Nothing like hate mail. Okay, so yes, you all understand my point now very, very clearly. Let's read a little bit more. Vayishlach otam Moshe l'tor et Eretz Kanan. And I want to skip a little bit. Take a look at the land. Mahi, Maharetz. Rav Soloveitchik also said that all of these things should have been asked rhetorically. The main reason is Posakuf. Maharetz Hashminahi Imraza. Hayesh Ba'etzim Ayin. Are there any trees there? Of course there are trees there. How do I know that there are trees there? Hold on to that question for a second. Are there trees there? Vitchazaktem Ulakachtem Mipri Haaretz. Vayamim Yimei Bikurei Anavim. So, I'm going to go back to my Garden of Eden. You realize that, look at that recognition. So you realize that Moshe's instruction to them is, are there trees there? And when you see the trees, then bring the fruits. But walking on fruits is going to be Mibikurei Anavim. The grapes are starting to form on the vine right now. I can show you my grapevine. And they went around, this is around Tisha B'Av time, you have grapes. Mibikurei Anavim. You're dealing with the very end of the season is around Sukkot time. This is Mibikurei, this is the very beginning of the grape season. The problem with the grapes, those of you who don't know, that the proper time that you need to do all the work to make wine is around Sukkot time. That's the end of the season when the grapes are perfect, and we already see Rashi was asked questions about this. Hold it, we allowed to work on Chol HaMoed? No, not necessarily. There's no evidence that Rashi worked in wine, but he knew about it and he lived within a larger area that wine was being grown, and he was asked about it. And the question was, can we work on Chol HaMoed? Because we need to. This is the time that we need to work, and anybody who's involved in the field will know that that's the issue as well. Okay. So I hope you all recognize that this issue of Mipri Haaretz Umibikurei, first fruits. You want to go backwards, you want to go forwards? You want to talk about the first fruit, or you want to talk about first fruits? Again, I'm just saying, I really hope that you understand what's going on, but in order to understand this properly, you'll need to see something else. First of all, does Moshe know that the land is a land which is a robust land full of fruits and so on? Does he know this? Of course he knows this. And how does he know this? The best answer that one can ever have to such things, and what's that? That God told him. There have been at least three occasions, I'll lay them out for you now. If you look at source number 4, which is by the burning bush, by the sneh, God says, V'ayred latzilom yad mitzrayim lotom in aretz ahi, el eretz tova urechava. Moshe should not have any questions about the land of Israel. Eretz tova rochava el eretz zavat chalav udvash. Right? El makom akniyach kitiya moriya v'prizvah chiviva yusin. So Moshe is told right here, there are these people that are living there now. It's not really an issue, but this is a great land, and it's a land which flows with milk and honey. Later on in Perek Yud Gimel, which is within the instructions of the Pesach Ledorot, we're told, Vayaki vecha Hashem el eretz akniyach kitiya moriya chiviva yusin, asher nishba la'avotecha. That's very important. Nishba lavotecha letet lach eretz zavat chalav udvash. That this land, which isn't promised you, which is a land, so everybody should know this at this point. By the way, if that's not good enough, even after the Chet HaEgel, in source number 6 in Perek Lamed Gimel, it says, V'deva Hashem Moshe, Lecha lei mize ata v'am asher alitam eretz Yisrael, el aretz asher nishbati l'avam l'Yitzchak l'Yaakov. By the way, it always goes back to that point. God promised this land to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Lei mor l'zarcha et nena. V'shalachti levechem malach, v'girashti et hakanani, amori, v'achiti, v'aprizi, hachivi v'usi, el eretz zavat chalav u'dvash. Ki lo ler bikir b'chai. This is even where God is saying, oh, I'm not going to be with you complete, whatever, but still, I'm going to send a malach, you're getting this land, this is the land that was promised, which means, when you look at the response of the Meraglim, you know, of the 10, it is so disturbing, because essentially, they have a lack of understanding of everything in Sefer Shemot to this point, and everything in Sefer Bereshit up to this point. Which means, where were you when we learned about Bereishit that God promised this land to Avram and to Yitzchak and to Yaakov? It sounds like you missed something along the way. I actually love the response that Kalev has. But again, Moshe's asking about bring the Pri Haaretz, and he notes that it's the Bikurei Anavim. If you look what it says that happens, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, V'yavo al Nachal Eshkol, V'yichudu Sham Zmura V'Eshkol, Anavim Echad V'yisu B'mot B'shnayim. So that is actually the picture I put on the bottom, that there were so many grapes that they had to carry it in, two people had to carry this one cluster of grapes. So they also brought U'min HaRimonim U'min HaTe'inim. So that's what they carried out, just in case you need to test people. And then you notice they came back Miketz Arba Imyon. And it also says they came back to a place called Kedesha, which is really going to be important, but we'll see how far we go. The second they see the Priya Aretz, what should they now be saying to themselves? Ah, right? It's good. And every, right. That is the land with flows of milk and honey, and this is the pri, which means, yes, what they know has now been established, but Ephes, this is not going to work, which, now, all this they were never asked to make a military assessment, a strategic assessment. And they start warning about Amalek. And the Chiti and the Vusi and Maria right are there. Of course they're there. I mean, that's we've been told that every single time. They're there, and they're going to be displaced. They're there, and God is giving this to you. I actually love the response. So again, one more thing we now need to keep in our minds. We also have Amalek to contend with. Right? Amalek. We have Amalek. We have the first fruits. Okay. Continue. And we have then the response of Kalev, Pasuk Lamed, Vayahas Kalev et ha'am el Moshe, Vayomer alo na'ale, V'yarashnu ota, ki achol nuchala. He says multiple things. The last thing he says is, yes, we can. Right? Yachol nuchalo, yes, we can. We can do it. The first thing that he said is, alo na'ale, let's go up. The middle thing that he says is actually the most important. It's V'yarashnu. This is our Yerusha. Which means the others seem to have this disconnection. And I'm going to go back and say this again. So what was the alternative? Stay in the desert? The desert is not theirs. Go to, I don't know, pick any place in the world that you want. No, that's not your. That's not theirs. What Kalev is saying, again, that one word, Yerusha. If you actually note moving forward in Perek Yedaled, God is going to respond and use that same word Yerusha a number of times. It is one of the motifs over here, which is quite important, but it's this recognition. It's not just that they say we can't do it, we can do it. We can do it, but this is our land. Meaning, Kalev is saying, I have read Sefer Bereishit. I have been paying attention till this point in Sefer Shemot, and therefore the Yerusha is one which should be absolutely obvious. Okay, and notice the give and take over here, nothing about God. I mean, there were other things to say. Oh yeah, by the way, it's not just the Yerusha, God has promised this to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It's not just the Yerusha, God is with us, and God, the same God who gave us man for breakfast, God is going to take us in over here. The same God who promised to take us out of Egypt also promised us by the Brit Ben Abtarim to give us the land, which means the God quotient or content over here is really quite important, but it's absent. And it's interesting that, you mentioned the non-religious settlers. So it's interesting that they speak without God and he responds without God to them. They don't mention God and he doesn't mention God. Later on, when it's going to be said in the next chapter and God hates us, they're going to respond with God within the sentence, which means Kalev seems to be a very, very clever individual, but it's more than being clever. He's responding to what is being said to him, not that, like many people, they already have their speech prepared, what they're going to say. He is very strategically responding to what was said, but nonetheless, he adds in that word, this Yerusha, this question of inheritance. So let me point out a couple of things, and then we'll all come to this realization about the limits that we have within time right now. In source number 10, no, I don't want 10. I want source number 11. See, source number 11 we have a hard time with, because one is the end of Parshat Ki Teitzeh, the other is the beginning of Parshat Ki Tavo. So for us, those are two separate weeks. By the way, before we made Aliyah, the last parsha that we had in America was Kitetze, and the first parsha we had here when we moved here was Kitavo. So right by that point in between is when we made Aliyah back in 1984. So Kitetze, right? For us, there's the separation, but in the Torah, you realize that it's somewhat artificial. It's artificial in terms of the chapters, because, you know, with all due respect to the archbishop, that's completely artificial. But even the parshiot, those are based upon the Babylonian way of dividing the Torah, that we read it every year, and in Israel they would finish it. The divisions were different. But over here, I just want to point out the obvious, which is not obvious, because we don't read it like that. But the end of Kitetze is a retrospective on Amalek. So that should be interesting, right? Here is where Parshat Zachar is introduced. So what happens immediately after Parshat Zachar? The answer is Kitavo al Aretz. And what does it talk about? It talk about Bikurim, first fruits. This is the mitzvah of Bikurim. So that should at least cause, you know, just to think for a second, hold it. Over here by the Chedem Araglim, they were told to bring the Bikurim, they were told to bring the first fruits, though the first fruit from Eretz Yisrael, and it was the time of the Bikurei Anavim, although we know that grapes are somewhat complex. But they were told to bring the from the Anavim, and Amalek then is presented as a reason that counters all of this. And I'm just going to say it right now, this relationship is a little bit more complex than I'm even setting it right out over here, but just realize these themes are interesting. If you look in our parsha, and I didn't put the source in front of you, it goes back to what I said by the very beginning about the mitzvot that appear. At the end of the Meraglim episode, and the very end is these people, the Mapilim, who decide we're going to go up anyway, and they go up anyway, and they are massacred. It says, Vayapilu la'alot el Rosh Ahar, right? Va'aron brit Hashem u'moshe lo mashub min kerev ha'machaneh, va'yered ha'amalaki va'knani ha'yoshev baharahu va'yakum va'yaktum ad ha'chorma. They came and they massacred them. And specifically, one second, specifically, Amalek is involved in this. You move then again, Perek Tetvav, it's a new Perek, or what does this have to do with anything? Now pay attention to what comes right afterwards. V'deber Hashem u'moshe lehem, v'deber b'nei Yisrael v'marte lehem, ki tavo ala Kitavo, right afterwards, Amalek, and then Kitavo. Over here, Amalek, and then Kitavo. That Kitavo, and Parsha Kitavo, is about the fruit. Over here, what's the Kitavo about? Kitavo, by the way, that itself should be incredibly positive. Yeah, you just got a penalty. You're going to be here for another, for 40 years altogether, and you're staying behind. Nonetheless, what does it say right afterwards? Kitavo. Now, just in case you think that there's no connection, whatever, Kitavo, I'm going to skip a little bit. I am in Perek, it's not there. It's Perek Tetvav. It's right afterwards. And it says that you're going to make a neder and a dava, or on your holidays, and you're going to bring the offerings. Right, and so on. And then it says, V'yayin l'nesech revitahim taseh alola l'zevech l'keves ha'achad. That you should bring wine as a libation. You should bring wine over here. Now, again, I can't stress how interesting this is. Actually, I will stress how interesting this is. The use of the wine over here is not an accident. The use of the wine is essentially taking those grapes and using them in a very holy way. Those grapes were taken out of the country and they were brought to the people in order to be the evidence. You know, and by the way, this Shabbos, no overseas wines. No wines from Chutz La'aretz. Right, the tikkun is to drink Israeli wine this week. Okay, if you don't drink wine, then send me a bottle, and I'll be a shliach. I'll take care of it for you. So this idea of the wine being introduced right over here, it's not an accident. It's actually so much better. But before I get to this, let me go back to what you already recognized that I was going to say. And that is that we know that there's a machloka regarding what was that Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra. Essentially, what kind of tree gets you to be confused between good and bad? So therefore, one of the suggestions which the Zohar likes the most is that it was from grapes. It was the wine. This point, look at source 12, the Rekanati. Rekanati is a commentary of the Ramban on his mystical elements. V'samach parshat nisachim leparshat meraglim lefi shechatu bizmurah hanizkeret hishirim biyichuda. They sinned by taking this out and getting to the wrong conclusion. So now they're told, listen, how do you use the grapes in a holy service? if you want, in source 13, Rav Tzaddik will tell you what the Zohar says. Zohar Kadosh in Parshat Shlach, v'yimim yimei bikurei anavim, v'yimim Micah. And he goes, which days? So he goes, no, you have to go all the way back to the beginning. Bahu zimna, bahu ilana, dechata be'adam arishon, kamad taninen anavim hayu. So therefore, no, this goes back. It's like you want to go backwards. This is that first sin that took place. It's somehow the grapes are involved. Rabbi Nachman, in source 14, is going to tell you that when they carried all the grapes out, they actually made some wine, and that's how they got confused, and that's how they ended up getting to the wrong understanding of what's going on over here. So that confusion, of course, goes back to the confusion from Eitz Hadat Tovara, the tree which causes you confusion between good and bad. And the thing which causes you this is the Nachash. And the Nachash, of course, is the Malach HaMavet. And, of course, is represented by Amalek, by the Sarosh El Esav, and so on and so forth. So, and I said, yes, I am beneath the surface right now, but I'm not as beneath the surface as you think. Yes, I just brought in some Kabbalistic sources that said some of these things, but let me point out something else. On page number 6... And by the way, what I'm skipping right now, what I shouldn't be skipping, is I'm skipping the emunah which is involved in the Milchama against Amalek, of Moshe lifting up his hands and Yoshua fighting. And there's a lot more to talk about the emunah which is there, because the people don't seem to have the proper emunah here. And by the way, you go back to the quote-unquote sin of Moshe, was, oh, the lack of the emunah. All of this is connected. But on page number 6, I brought you, it's from a book which is called HaMikra V'Misara. The book is like this thin. It's really, really thin. You could probably get it from Osada Rav Kook for like 8 shekel or something. I don't even think I'm exaggerating. It's a couple of essays from one of the most interesting and prolific authors of the 20th century. His name was Reuven Margoliot. And he wrote big books, little books. He wrote lots of footnotes in his books. Probably, again, there. I have at home around 20 different... He ended up becoming a librarian in Tel Aviv. Yeah, and he wrote a book on Shulchan Aruch, which has Haskama from Rav Kook. Well, he also wrote in Europe before he got here. He wrote in Europe before he got here. He has Haskama from Rav Kook in one of his, at least one of his farm. And when he got here, he put out the Masada Rav Kook Zohar. All those footnotes are his footnotes. And he actually has another sefer which takes all the footnotes and puts it in the order of Shas, so that he can go through every single sugi, the Sharei Zohar, it's called. And he was very well versed in everything. I just would like in everything. When I was learning in yeshiva, I'm going back to 79. So we learned Sanhedrin, and the Rebbe had in front of him the Magolio Tayam, and that was his whole shir. He would just look. So he wrote on Masechet Sanhedrin, sugi by sugi by sugi, telling him all the interesting Rishonim, all the interesting Achronim, and anything Kabbalistic that you need to know. And it was just, you know, by sugi, and it was actually really absolutely phenomenal. In this little essay, which is in source 17, now what I did is those things that you can't read on the bottom of page 5, if you're interesting, you just send me an email, I'll send you the actual article. Those are the footnotes. The footnotes, I couldn't fit them all in and get myself to 6 pages. But in source 17, in, again, this little book, HaMikra V'Misara, he writes, Mevurechet Artzeinu B'Yivul Admata V'Tznuvat Sadeho U'Karmeha V'Nishtabcha B'Shiv'a Minei Gdula Karkotea Haita Eretz Chitaso Ora V'Gefen V'Teina Rimon Zayt Shemen U'Dvash. And Achrei Chita V'Sara Shin Menu Rishona Haya HaGefen HaMatsui B'Yoter Ba'aretz. Right? Wine or grapes. One of the things the Muslims did is they uprooted all the grapes. There is a fellow named Shivi Drury, Dr. Shivi Drury, who is a winemaker, and he's a lecturer in Ariel University. His father is Rav Drury, the Rav of Rav Tzfanya Drury, the Rav of Kiryat Shmona. And Shivi Drury has rediscovered some of the ancient types of grapes that existed over here, because, as I said, many of the grapes were just destroyed. I mean, that was what the Muslims left us, because they were against the drinking of wine, so they decided it would be good to get rid of all of the grapes. But he says grapes were, and part of what he's going to do is to bring sources to show you how popular grapes are. But he makes actually a claim. And that's the purpose of this article. He makes a claim. The claim is that when it says Eretz Zavat Chalav U'Dvash, that Chalav does not mean milk from a cow. because that has nothing to do with an eretz. Eretz zavat chalav udvash, it's something, and it's not from a bee, because that's not an eretz. So therefore, all of you hopefully know, right, one of the important things about our Middle Eastern cooking that I hope that you've adopted by this point is that you should be using date honey, silan. It will make the food taste a little bit different than you were used to back in Chutz Laretz. But there's honey, biblical honey, is either from dates or from figs. That's biblical honey, not from bees. So Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash, the Dvash is, and Rashi points this out a number of times. The Dvash is talking about Dvash from Te'anim or others. But the Chalav, he claims the Chalav is from the grapes. It's white wine. He said, Eretz Zavat Chalav Udvash. And by the way, when one of the things that he points out in one of these footnotes is that when the people come back, when the spies come back, what is it that they have? It says, back at source number one, Pasuk of Zayin, V'yisapru lo, v'yamru banu ala aretz asher lachanu, v'gam zavat chalav udvashi, v'zeh pirya. Which means, what are those words? No, so what is he showing them? He's showing them what we just now were told. What do they have? They have te'anim, they have rimonim, and they have grapes. So that's exactly the point of this pasuk. So he, by the way, goes through all kinds of verses showing that when it said chalav in those verses, it actually meant white wine along the way, and it was such an obvious thing to anybody, you know, reading it back in the day. The problem is that we became very disconnected to the land, and we became very disconnected to the grapes, and we became very, and for us, milk became the obvious translation of this. But he claims that that's just not what it means in terms of numerous biblical sources, and most importantly, this one over here. So that's what I want to say. When it said after that it was the Yimei of the Bikurei Anavim, yes, the Anavim is part of the story over here, which therefore, when immediately afterwards we're told about the Nisachim, that you need to now do the Tikkun with the grapes and use it in the Beit HaMikdash, although it's very interesting, because that tikkun does not include drinking it. It includes libation, to pour it out. Drinking it could get a little dangerous sometimes. First of all, it creates an incredible aroma. I don't know if you ever cook with wine. I do. But the taste is going to be good also. But it creates this incredible aroma aside from everything else. So it's just very interesting now. And that's what I said from the very beginning. You need to track the mitzvah, which are in Bamidbar, compared to the narrative, which is right beforehand. And this is not just this coincidence. And then we go back again to this Mocham against Amalek. Amalek is the one right after Ski Tavoa La'aretz. Now you take your first fruits and you bring them off to Yerushalayim, which means the use of the fruit over here should remind us. Anytime the first fruit's there, you should be thinking, all the way back to the first fruit. Coming into Eretz Yisrael, we're supposed to become farmers. We're supposed to become connected to the land. We should feel the connection to the land. It's one of Yerusha. Again, this is our land. And I'm not saying that, the secular Zionist dream of working the land as opposed to the religious dream of studying it, obviously it's the combination. I mean, part of the issue in the background of all of this is Emunah. Chazal tell us, what is Emunah? It's Zra'im, is Emunah. Because the farmer realizes that God is the senior partner, because God is going to provide the sun, and God is going to provide the rain, and God is going to provide all of the things that we need for the things to grow properly. You're going to go and do the backbreaking work, and then God is your partner. And that emunah is actually what happens when one is involved in this work. So apparently, again, just like Yosef saw the future and where we're supposed to be, and everyone else sees things from the present, the spies could not imagine that future, and the future looked too difficult, and instead they want to remain in the present. The people then who became hysterical, they said, okay, let's go back to the past, right? It was better in Egypt. I mean, again, the type of insanity that requires to say that. But that's what fear does. I mean, fear creates situations like this. But it's that one word, you know, of Kalev. It's the Yerusha. This is our inheritance. And essentially, as a collective, we have the inheritance of two things. One inheritance is Torah. I, as a rabbi or somebody who knows Torah or knows certain things in Torah, have no right to deny somebody else knowledge in Torah because it's not mine. It belongs to all of us. It belongs to the collective. Somebody comes over and says, can you teach me this? I can say, no, I'm not teaching. Well, what do you mean? It's my inheritance. The problem is that there are Jews that don't sense that that's the inheritance. The land of Israel is the inheritance of the collective. Again, as Rav Soloveitchik said at least on one occasion, if all the Jews in the world were to get together and say, we renounce our rights to the land of Israel, it's not binding. The reason it's not binding is because we don't own it, although we are caretakers who have inherited it, who have an obligation of passing it on to the next generation. Which means God gave the Torah and God gave the land of Israel to the collective Jewish people. Collective Jewish people, all the Jews in the past and all the Jews in the present and all the Jews in the future. And our responsibility is to take the Torah that we receive from the past and pass it on to the future. And our responsibility is to take the land of Israel, which was promised in the past, and take care of it and then pass it on to the future. And over here, there were people who, there was at least one person who understood this aspect of Yerusha, who understood this aspect of inheritance. V'yarashta v'yashafta is the term which is used other times in the Torah, and you should inherit it and you should settle within it. And then there were those who just could not imagine the Yerusha, they couldn't imagine the next step, and they couldn't imagine actually working their hands and working the land and getting their hands dirty and then creating this incredible social justice, which is really taking the values of the Torah and applying it in a real-life situation of a collective, which is actually what the goal of all of this is. So I'm going to say it again. There was a potential over here to do something very, very different. There was a potential to answer the call and go marching or running into the land of Israel with so much exuberance and so much faith and so much emunah in order to start that next stage that anybody who was there would have just said, the rightful owners are back home, because pretenders always know ultimately that they are pretenders. And they would have just said, okay, the rightful owners are here. But instead of us feeling that this is really ours, we stayed on the outside and saying, no, we really can't do it. And the answer is, yes, we can do it. But why can we do this? Because this is something which we've inherited. This is something which God promised us. This is something which God promised to Avraham and Yaakov. And now you realize that beautiful Midrash, which is in the Gemara, that Kalev, he goes to the Maror Machpelah. Why does he go to the Maror Machpelah? Because he knows that this is a question of Yerusha. So of course he goes to the Maror Machpelah, essentially saying, to the Elter Zeda, we're back. We're coming back now.